So I want to talk about what kinds of options there are for the Palestinians, short-term options, longer-term possibilities that might be realized farther down the road, and also what we can learn from the South African experience and what it suggests about appropriate tactical choices. These are things that you can't issue slogans about if you care about the victims. You have to think them through carefully. So start with short-term possibilities. There's a lot of discussion of this, huge amount. Almost universally, it keeps to two possibilities, two options. One of them is the two-state formula that has overwhelming international support, effectively everyone except the United States and Israel. The second option is that Israel takes over all of the occupied territories, actually what we, since November, ought to be calling occupied Palestine, and I'll call it that. And after Israel takes it all over, there'll be a civil rights struggle and anti-apartheid struggle of modeled on South Africa. Those are the two options. Virtually nothing else is discussed, which is unfortunate because the discussion systematically leaves out the third and most realistic option. That is that Israel will continue with U.S. backing to do exactly what it's doing right now. And it's not a secret what it's doing. First, Gaza is separated from the West Bank. That's been U.S.-Israeli policy since for over 20 years in explicit violation of the Oslo Accords of 1993, which declare that the two are an indissoluble territorial entity. And it's very important to separate them because that means whatever kind of autonomy might ever be realized in the West Bank will be isolated from the outside world. The only real contact with the outside world could be through Gaza, seaport, airplanes, and so on, even to Egypt. So therefore, this U.S.-Israeli policy is really quite sensible and important. Keep them separated from one another. In Gaza, meanwhile, will remain a prison and under siege and regular punching bag in the manner that we've seen for the last 20 years, in fact, really dating back to 1948. What about the West Bank? Well, in the West Bank, the plans are quite clear. They've actually been in process since 1967. They're fairly explicit in internal documents in Israel, more coming out all the time, and also in practice. They've had various forms over the years, but the basic structure is approximately the same. Israel will take over anything that's valuable. That means everything inside on the Israeli side of the what they call the separation wall, actually should be called an annexation wall, arable land, water resources, the nice suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which happen to be on the opposite side of the border. It'll take over what's now called Jerusalem. It's a huge area, far beyond anything that was ever called Jerusalem. It will take over approximately, probably 40%, maybe 50% roughly, of what's called Area C. Area C is the largest of the regions, approximately 60% of the West Bank that Israel carved out, and it's systematically taking them over. There isn't a very dense population, Palestinian population there, but they're being expelled. Crucially, Israel will take over the Jordan Valley. That's very crucial, for one thing, again, arable land and water resources, but also that completes the imprisonment. It means there's no access to Jordan, let alone any other place. And that's happening in the traditional way, slowly, without too much fanfare, but going on. 1967, there were about 300,000 Palestinians in the Jordan Valley, and now it's down to less than 60,000. About over three quarters has already been taken over, Palestinians expelled, and it continues. The usual traditional methods are being used. Not some is just straight expulsion, but a lot of it is establishment of what are called military zones, from which all people are excluded except Israeli settlers who go back in, and finally their settlements are authorized and linked up to the electrical grid, the water, and so on. Nature reserves, approximately the same. It's called in Israel, pretty frankly now, in Hebrew, Tihur Babika, cleansing of the valley, which is what it is. Its details are instructive. Every couple of days you see something. A couple of weeks ago, 60 people, I'm quoting from the Israeli press, 60 people were expelled, 36 children, 46 dwellings destroyed. That included tents that had been brought in by the Red Cross and other humanitarian organizations to house people who had already been expelled from some other part of the valley. Soldiers checked every vehicle to make sure they contained no humanitarian support. Water in containers was spilled. Point is, make sure they get out. That's the idea. We don't want them here. They're an alien presence in the whole country, in fact, and slowly get rid of them. In addition to what I just described, there are corridors cutting through. One corridor to the east of Greater Jerusalem, to the town of Maale Adumim, was built mostly after the Oslo agreements under Clinton, by now a pretty large town. I was there in the early stages. The Bedouin, were so-called Bedouin, the people who lived there were driven out, living in tin huts. Now they're expelled further. The town is by now a fairly large town. It's to be connected to Greater Jerusalem. There's a little conflict over there. There's a corridor between Greater Jerusalem and Maale Adumim. Maale Adumim, incidentally, extends virtually to Jericho, its lands. So that essentially bisects. The point of building it was to bisect the what's left of the West Bank. The corridor, you may have seen some discussion of it, is called E1, East 1. And it's a corridor that Israel's been wanting to develop for about 20 years, ever since Maale Adumim was taking off, because that would complete the bisection. It's interesting that the U.S. administrations have blocked it. When the U.S. tells Israel something, it has to do it. The relations of power are such that order comes from Washington, you do it. Unless it's the kind of order that comes kind of with a wink, which says, you know, here's what we're saying, but you do what you like. And that's Obama, essentially. He's the first U.S. president who has done nothing but wink, first one who has imposed no restrictions, no sanctions on Israel, and that is also true of E1. Up until now, Israel's not been able to build there. It kind of did a few things, like put up a police station or something like that, but it couldn't really develop it. And Obama told them to, you can't develop it, but he told them in his traditional way, you can't develop it, but if you develop it, we're not going to do anything about it. So they'll probably go ahead. That's one corridor. There's another corridor to the north, going to the town of Ariel. Those of you who follow Israeli politics will notice that there's a big surprise in the last election. The Yair Lapid ticket, Yesh Atid, there's a future, won a big section of the vote. They're mostly the kind of what they call the kind of middle class, moderate vote, you know, folks like us. Lapid didn't say a thing about the Palestinians or the occupied territories, except symbolically. He opened his campaign in the town of Ariel, right in the middle of the West Bank. That's where the second corridor goes. And that's telling anybody who wanted to know, okay, now you know what I am. It's very similar to Ronald Reagan in 1980. He opened his campaign in the town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, carefully chosen because it was the site of one of the major civil rights massacres. And that was telling the country, don't worry about me, I'm going to be a racist thug, which in fact he was. Lapid, I think, is saying the same thing. Otherwise, there's no point opening the campaign in Ariel. North of that, there's another corridor, goes to a couple of other towns. So, in effect, it breaks up whatever remains into cantons, which are more or less unviable. They can survive, but basically unviable. Probably altogether, it'll amount to, say, roughly 40-50% of the West Bank taken over. Incidentally, there are going to be very few Palestinians in the area that Israel's taking over, which means there will be no civil rights struggle and no anti-apartheid struggle. There won't be what's called a demographic problem, the problem of too many Palestinians in a Jewish state. So that alternative, though it's talked about a lot, there's no reason to expect it to happen. No reason to expect the U.S. and Israel to agree to take over all of occupied Palestine. They don't want it. What they want is what's valuable. That's roughly this. They've been proceeding, and every reason to believe will continue to proceed to take it over. No civil rights struggle, no anti-apartheid struggle, no demographic problem. That's the real alternative to a two-state solution, settlement. Those are the two alternatives. The other is not an alternative for the short term. Well, what about the longer term? One possibility, and one that, just speaking personally, I've thought was better all my life. I was an activist on this issue back in the 1940s. And that's what used to be called a binational state. In its current resurrection in the last couple of years, it's called one state. But it's in fact a binational state. There's no overcoming the fact that there are two national groups, two languages, two cultures, two histories, could be integrated, but it would be a binational state. So as I say, I've always thought that's the right thing to strive for. But of course, we want to reach the goal, not just talk about it. And if you want to reach the goal, then you have to sketch out a path from where we are to how we get there. Otherwise, it's just talk. Kind of like, let's get rid of nuclear weapons. Yeah, we can say it, have a conference about it, but unless we say how we're going to do it, it's nice rhetoric. It's not actually a proposal. So how can we get from here to there? Well, that varies over the years. Depends on the circumstances. So pre-1948, when, as I say, I was teenage activist on this issue, there was a direct way to do it. Just go directly to that settlement, binational state and mandatory Palestine. By 1948, that option was closed. Various things happened in the following years, but the option opened up again in 1967. In 1967, when Israel took over the whole territory, there was, in fact, a possibility to move quite directly to some form of federalism, integration, and there was some support for it within the Palestinian community, even in Israeli military intelligence. Actually, I was writing and speaking about it quite a lot in those years, from roughly 67 to mid-70s. Didn't get anywhere because there was total hostility. Nobody wanted to hear about it. So I think it was a real opportunity, but it was lost. And now everything that's happened, now that the idea has been resurrected, all of that has been forgotten, which I think is a mistake. It's useful to know something about recent history. Well, by the mid-70s, this option was closed because Palestinian national rights had entered the international agenda. And idea of a two-state settlement was quickly formulated and brought to the Security Council, supported by, as I said, essentially the whole world. The first formal expression of it was in January 1976 at the Security Council, the three major Arab states, so-called confrontation states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, brought a resolution to the Security Council, January 76, in which they called for a two-state settlement on the international border. And there's no debate about what the international border is. It's basically the ceasefire line from 1949. It's universally accepted outside of Israel and the U.S. On the international border with possible minor and mutual modifications. That actually was official U.S. policy at the time. Minor and mutual modifications, because it's a ceasefire line, you know, so it's kind of irregular and things like that, so straighten it out. Then it went on, the resolution went on to call for guarantees for the rights of each state in the region, that's Israel and a new Palestinian state, to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized borders. Those of you familiar with the diplomacy on this issue will know that that's the wording of UN 242, which everyone at least formally accepts, now extended to Israel and a new Palestinian state. Israel refused to attend the session. The United States vetoed the resolution. It's important to know that when the U.S. vetoes a resolution, it's a double veto because of the way power works. First of all, it doesn't happen, obviously, but also it's vetoed from history. So you're going to have to search to find it. You don't see it in the media. You don't see it in most scholarship. You want to find it, you have to look at critical scholarship or at the original sources, like you can read about it in the New York Times in late January 1976. Incidentally, this happens all the time. Since the mid-60s, when decolonization had set in, the U.S. is way in the lead in vetoing resolutions on all kinds of topics. Britain is second, and no one else is even close. But that's vetoed from history, too. It's just history, not acceptable history. That's 1976. There was another similar resolution in 1980, also vetoed by the United States. That's Carter this time. Then the Security Council ruled out. Discussion shifts over to the General Assembly, where there's almost annual resolutions, more or less the same, roughly along these lines. And the typical votes are 150-3, everyone except United States, Israel, maybe Marshall Islands or El Salvador or something like that. Those are the typical votes on a whole range of issues, incidentally. Virtually none of them ever get reported, but it's typical of the structure of global society, if you want to look at the real world. I won't run through the details, and it continues up till the present. The most recent Security Council resolution actually did get a little notice, unusual. It was February 2011 under Obama. The United States vetoed a resolution which called for implementation of official U.S. policy. That was a little unusual. So it therefore got the veto, therefore, you know, got a couple of words of commentary. The resolution called for a termination of expansion of settlements. That's supposed to be the debatable issue. It's almost insignificant. The issue of expansion of settlements doesn't mean very much. The real issue is the settlements, which have the character that I described, not the expansion. But there was a very mild resolution reiterating official U.S. policy, and Susan Rice vetoed it, gave some explanation as to why, and so that received some attention. But in any event, that's the basic picture. Come back to what it implies. We should bear it in mind. Going back to 75, from that point on, one option for the first time was a two-state settlement. Does that rule out a binational settlement? No, it doesn't. It just sketches a different path towards it. It says if you really want to get to a binational state or so-called one-state settlement, that's an idea that was revived in the last couple of years, if you want to, then that's what you start with. Two-state settlement, essentially the whole world is in favor of it. That would reduce the cycle of violence. Almost immediately, relations would improve across the borders. Anyone familiar with this area knows there's absolutely no way of drawing a reasonable border through Cisjordan, Mandatory Palestine. In fact, every time in the past when violence has declined, it happens very quickly. Commercial relations and cultural relations and so on. Now, that could very well lead to closer integration, maybe some form of federal arrangement, some kind of binational system. If there's another way of reaching that, I've never seen it. There's a lot of talk about it, but that's the only proposal that I know, meaning the only proposal that says, well, here's where we are, how can we get there? If you have another one, be interested in hearing it. I've read a lot about this, but there are never any proposals that I can find. So I think that's a possibility, but and a serious one. But as far as I can see, it has to be reached in stages. Incidentally, I've never thought that that should be the end of the process. I don't see any reason at all to worship the borders that were imposed by imperial force. They don't mean anything either. All over the world, the borders have been imposed by imperial violence, which includes the United States, incidentally. The Mexico-U.S. border, for example, is just imposed by violence. The U.S. carried out an aggressive war. It conquered half of Mexico, imposed a border. In the last, it was a pretty open border for a long time. Same people live on both sides. Under Clinton, the border was militarized. That coincided with NAFTA, and I presume the reason was it was understood that that NAFTA would have a devastating effect on Mexican agriculture and small business, and people would start fleeing across the border, so we better militarize it. And the other borders around the world are approximately the same, actually. Happened to see this personally in the early 50s. My wife and I were students at Harvard, in fact. And we were living for a while in a kibbutz in Israel, and we were hitchhiking, students do, you know, backpacking around northern Israel, and we just walked into Lebanon. There was no border marked, and there can't be any. Galilee is just one continuous place, like most places in the world. Some guy drove by in a Jeep and yelled at us we were in the wrong country, we should come back, so we came back. But I think there's every reason to want those borders, same elsewhere in the world, but here at least, to be eroded, move towards further regional integration. I think it's healthy for the people concerned, it's quite possible, and within that context, I think there could be some kind of resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem. Short of that, I don't see any path to dealing with that problem. We can talk about it, but again, a proposal means a path from here to there. And in terms of a regional settlement, there might be a significant path to do something about the miserable circumstances of the refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, elsewhere. Well, that's a longer-term possibility, and my own feeling is that's a rough sketch of what the options are, you know, talk in more detail. Well, let's turn to the next topic, apartheid, South Africa, and what we can learn from that. Here I think we have to be pretty cautious. Within Israel itself, what's called Israel, you know, there's plenty of repression and violence. I've written a lot about it for 40 years and give you details. But I don't think that apartheid is an appropriate term for it. Rather, it's the kind of thing that exists in much of the world, including the United States, in slightly different forms, one place or another. Repressive, often violent. So for example, in the United States, it's now it's coming on 400 years since the first African Americans were brought here as slaves. If you look over this period, 400 years, there's maybe 40 years of relative freedom, and the present period isn't one of them. Well, okay, that's really pretty awful, but I wouldn't call it apartheid. It's some other thing, you know, another name for it. And I think the same is true of a lot of the repression in Europe, which is extremely racist, has horrible treatment of minorities, and also in Israel. So I just don't think the analogy is really quite appropriate there. What about within occupied Palestine? Well, there you can make a better case. So for example, this morning, if you happen to be reading the newspapers, there was a report, another B'Tselem report. B'Tselem's the Israeli, main Israeli human rights organization. And it describes something that just happened in Hebron. Anybody's been in Hebron, you know what it's like. There's a small number of Jewish settlers, a lot of them from the United States, very brutal, racist, religious extremists, very violent. You know, they walk around beating people up, overturning fruit stands, writing racist graffiti on the walls. They can do anything they like, throwing stones at Palestinian children. And they're protected. There's a big contingent of the Israeli army there, so they're protected. This morning, or at least this morning's report, describes a new stage. There's a road from Hebron to the Tomb of the Patriarchs, you know, the place where people pray, both religions. And they just divided it into two parts. One part is a paved road for Jews. The other part is a rutted dirt road. There's pictures of it in the B'Tselem report. You know, you can sort of stumble along it. You can't push a cart. I have a picture of a man on a wheelchair. He can't do it, and there's steps at one end. That's apartheid. You know, that's real apartheid. Nevertheless, I don't think and there are other things like it. I still think the analogy is inappropriate, and the reason is the occupied Palestine is much worse than apartheid, much worse. So calling it apartheid, I think, is quite inaccurate. You take a look back at South Africa. The large majority of the population in South Africa, 85% or so, was black. And they needed that population. That was their workforce. It's kind of like the slave South in prebellum South. The black population was required. That's the workforce. They do all the work. They're a capital investment. So you have to, like your car, you have to keep it functioning. So the slave owners had a commitment to the slaves, and the white South Africans had a commitment to their to the blacks that they drove into Bantustans. They'd sustain them, keep them functioning. In fact, it's kind of striking that after the Civil War in the United States, around 10 years after the Civil War, after a very brief period of kind of formal freedom, a version of slavery was reintroduced by a North-South compact. And this, for the slave owners, was much better, because what happened is essentially what's happening now. Black life was criminalized, which drove blacks, first black males, then other blacks, back into the prison system. And at that point, the state takes care of them. So that's terrific for the owners. We're familiar with chain gangs and agriculture, but it went way beyond that. A large part of the American Industrial Revolution was based on it. Mines and steel mills and so on went on virtually to the Second World War. And for the owners, that's an improvement, much better than slavery. Going back to South Africa, they did have to maintain the black population, and they were also trying to get some international recognition for the Bantustans, so they tried to make them look more or less viable. They didn't get much, but they tried. That's not true in occupied Palestine. Israel doesn't want the Palestinians. It wants them to get out. They don't belong here. They're an alien presence in the land of Israel. They know kind of mythology about it, and they're pretty frank about it. So they don't want to sustain them. They don't want to do anything for them, make things as rough as possible so they'll get out. Now, I got to qualify that a little, because Israel did realize that, in fact, it was explicit, Israeli industrialists realized back 10 or 15 years ago, that it would make sense to establish what they called a traditional neo-colonial relationship with Palestine. Neo-colonial means like the former colonies. You take a look at the know, any place, in worst place in sub-Saharan Africa, or in any place you pick, people live in misery. But there's a sector that lives very well. You know, there's a town somewhere, you know, very rich people, richer than we are, you know, wonderful amenities, all sorts of things. That's what you do for the elite. You keep them living in luxury. It's a nice tourist spot and stuff like that. Shows how munificent you are, and they're kind of quiet, and the rest can rot. And that's the idea. So you go to Ramallah, nice life, you know, theaters, restaurants, you know, kind of like, you know, Cambridge, maybe better than Cambridge. So a typical neo-colonial arrangement. But in general, Israel has no use for the Palestinians. So it's worse than apartheid. Shows up in all kinds of ways. This morning's one example. There is a real analogy, which isn't discussed much, but I think is valuable and worth thinking about. The real analogy, in my opinion, is that, I've written about this, that we know from declassified documents that by around 1960, the apartheid regime realized that they're becoming an international pariah. In fact, in 1958, the South African foreign minister called in the American ambassador and told him, frankly, you know, we're becoming an international pariah, we're getting delegitimized, everyone's voting against us in the United Nations. This is 1958. But we don't really care as because you and I both know there's only one vote in the United Nations, that's yours. And as long as you vote for us and support us, we're okay. So if the whole world, you know, says we're horrible and so on and so forth, fine, we'll get along fine. Well, that's pretty much what happened if you look at it. Not entirely, but pretty much. So in mid-70s, the United Nations declared an arms embargo. By the late 70s, there were the beginnings of the sanctions, boycotts and so on, scattered. But by the 80s, they were really taking shape. By the mid-80s, Ronald Reagan vetoed congressional sanctions, and Congress overrode his vetoes. So he was forced to continue his support for South Africa. He was a very strong supporter of apartheid. He had to continue do it by evading congressional legislation. Now, he had a logic to it. It wasn't out of nowhere. You have to remember that the so-called War on Terror, it was not declared by George Bush. It was declared by Ronald Reagan in 1981. Came into office saying international terrorism, core of our foreign policy, and so on. And there was a terrorist group in South Africa. It was called the African National Congress. In 1988, right at the end of the period, the Reagan administration declared the African National Congress, Mandela's Congress, to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Well, obviously, you have to protect the white population from some of the worst terrorists in the world. So therefore, it was necessary to evade congressional sanctions, increase trade, and figure out ways to get oil and military aid to them, and so on. So that takes us to the late 80s. Now, at that point, two important things happened. One of them we're not supposed to talk about. It's not politically correct. One of them had to do with Cuba. Cuba played an enormous role in liberating black Africa. It started earlier than that. It started in the 80s. Cuba sent soldiers, and crucially black soldiers, to Angola first, and they drove out the South African invaders, liberated Angola, other countries too. Now that was doubly important. For one thing, it liberated them, but for another, it was psychologically very significant, because there's a whole mythology about the invincible white mercenaries, you know, it goes back to the early days of colonialism. Well, here are black soldiers coming in and kicking them out. And that had a big effect both on South Africa and on black Africa. And strikingly, Cuba never took any credit for this. It's an act of international solidarity that has absolutely no counterpart in history. They didn't want it, they let the black leaders in Southern Africa take the credit for it. They wanted them to take the credit for it because they wanted to liberate them, not to get plaudits. And in fact, it's only very recently they've even allowed their archives to be opened. The United States was all hysterical about communist aggression and so on. But that's in fact what happened. By the late 80s, it extended to Namibia. South Africa was holding Namibia in violation of Security Council orders. Cuba, again, black armies, drove them out of Namibia. That was a big blow, again, both strategically and also psychologically. So that's one thing that happened. The other thing that happened is that around 1990 or so, the United States changed its policy. We don't have records from that period, so you have to guess, but it looks as though U.S. corporate sector, U.S. government, South African white business realized that they would probably do better if they allowed black faces in the limousines, but reinstituted pretty much the same economic system. And that's essentially what happened. So apartheid collapsed, which is a great victory. I don't mean to demean it. It was a tremendous victory. But for most of the population, it doesn't mean a lot. You know, but the mass of the black population is as bad off, sometimes worse off than before. We saw that recently in the great strikes. But it is different. It's actually kind of like the civil rights struggle here, not unlike that in some ways. And it was a recognition that this is just a pointless system. What we want is the economic system and the wealth and the power, and we can keep it by getting rid of the worst aspects of apartheid. So apartheid collapsed, which is a great victory by the early 90s. And that's pretty much how it collapsed. Well, that tells us something. I do think there are lessons from that for Israel-Palestine. It was primarily, there isn't any Cuba around in this case, but there is the United States. The United States is blocking, have 35 years now, has been blocking what a short-term option, two-state settlement, which in my view could be a stage, in fact the only stage I can think of, towards preferable longer-term options. So we might ask, what kind of tactics does that suggest to us? Well, I think the primary tactic it suggests to us is pretty much what was done in South Africa. The organized actions against apartheid, which by the 80s were pretty significant, that followed a long period of education and organization, decades. By the time sanctions were talked about even, there was just overwhelming opposition to apartheid, almost universal. Even business was opposed to it formally. As I said, Congress was passing sanctions, UN passing sanctions. At that point, it did make sense to begin using what are now called BDS tactics. It's worth remembering there was no BDS movement in the case of South Africa. Nobody ever dreamed of having a BDS movement. Rather, there was resort to those tactics, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, selectively targeted, considering the impact, dual impact. First of all, what would it mean to South Africa? And secondly, the educational impact. When you carry out a sanctions program, you're aiming it at the audience that you want to enlist in it. So you want to know how they're going to react to the program that I'm proposing. And that was done pretty sensibly in the case of South Africa. Sometimes wrong, but often very effectively. And it ended up being an effective program. It did ultimately bring even the Reagan administration around to joining. Although I should tell you, maybe you know, that Nelson Mandela himself was just removed from the terrorist list about 4 or 5 years ago. He can now come into the United States without special dispensation. So, you know, maybe slow, but it finally happened. And I think that tells us something too. Any of these tactics, however they're used, there's an effect, for going back to Israel, there's an effect on Israel. It contributes to what they call the delegitimization of Israel, which is a fine thing to do. They should be delegitimized when they're doing things like this. And that's a cost. And it also educates people here, if it's done correctly. If you pick and think about the tactics correctly, it can the tactic is indeed addressed right here to Americans and Britain, to Britons and so on. And you want it to be a contribution to the educational process, which ultimately can lead to a mass popular movement, which will change policy, as has happened in plenty of other things, including South Africa. And so by now, this is fairly mainstream. So Amnesty International, a couple of years ago, did call for an arms embargo to Israel, pointing out that U.S. arms sent to Israel are sent in strict violation of U.S. law. That's very clear. It's an organizing technique that should be used, especially with AI behind it. A Human Rights Watch, which is usually very conservative, particularly on this issue, considering their funding base, they've come out with a pretty strong position. They called on the U.S. government to end any aid to Israel that is in any way connected to support for the occupation. That's pretty broad, and I'm glad to see it. I think that can be built upon as a further technique, and there are other things that can be done. Well, there has been a lot of progress in the last few years. I think it was like a meeting like this would have been inconceivable a couple of years ago. Now it's all over the country. A couple of days ago, I talked at the MIT Israel Apartheid Week conference, also kind of like this. Just a few years ago, not many years ago, I mean, I've been talking about these things for 50 years, until pretty recently, first of all, extremely small and mostly very hostile groups, but also police protection. I mean, even at MIT, where I teach, I had to have police protection if I was giving a talk on this topic. You know, police would insist on accompanying my wife and me back to our car. The meetings were broken up, just physically broken up. Even meetings led by leading Israeli human rights activists. Some of it was pretty awful. It was all over the country. I might give you examples. But that's changed radically. By now, the atmosphere on college campuses, at least, is totally different. If anything, kind of the opposite. And that's real progress. That's going to affect the country altogether if it's pursued properly. It's happened on other issues. South Africa's one, but there's plenty of others, including civil rights issues, women's rights, anti-war, everything else. That's the only way anything ever happens. It always involves committed, dedicated popular movements which work hard to reach out, and if they pick the right tactics, can do it. Well, suppose you can get to the first stage, say a two-state settlement, which I think is feasible. After all, the whole world is for it. It's just U.S. opposition, very much like South Africa in that respect. Well, that's not going to be paradise by any means, just as it isn't in South Africa, just as it isn't with the civil rights movement and so on, and that's pretty normal. Popular struggles can achieve something significant, real triumphs, but never complete. You know, they're at best stages which kind of leave some kind of legacy from which you can hope to build further, to reach further goals, and what the further goals should be, you can figure out for yourself. I told you what I think, but you can think about it for yourself. But as always, it's going to take what it always requires, a lot of dedication, a recognition that you're not going to win great successes tomorrow, a commitment to a long-term struggle, and in general, a kind of a willingness to be engaged for the long haul. Thanks.
Noam Chomsky addressing a packed auditorium at Harvard Science Center on Friday, March 8th. This was followed by a two-part question and answer session. The first part was moderator Hike Shutton, who asked Professor Chomsky to elaborate on some of his comments. Then she opened it up to the floor and took questions from the audience.